Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into Iris today. You're about to hear the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 26th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast, this one coming from KCRG. Showers and storms likely at times through Sunday, with severe risk possible. Expect an active weekend around eastern Iowa at times, with several rounds of shower and storm potential. Widespread showers and storms are likely on Friday morning, with heavier downpours and frequent lightning likely. Severe weather is unlikely with this round of activity due to a lack of the proper ingredients in the atmosphere to promote those stronger storms. Still, plan on a wet commute to work and school in most locations. Activity reaches the Interstate 380 corridor by 8 o'clock a.m., and closer to the Dubuque area around 9 o'clock a.m. or a little later. Showers and storms continue into lunchtime and even parts of the afternoon, with occasional lulls at times. Additional storm activity develops to our west and southwest this afternoon, moving northeast toward eastern Iowa later this evening. This is the round today that carries the risk for some severe weather, with our western and southwestern counties more favored for that potential. This storm activity could enter the western edge of the area by around 5 or 6 o'clock, moving northeast and affecting the Interstate 380 corridor around 7 or 8 o'clock, getting closer to the Mississippi River by 9 or 10. The threat for severe weather will be highest in those initial hours, where the storms will still have good access to the energy needed to promote severe weather. As the evening goes on, storms may outpace that energy a bit and potentially weakening as they head out of the area. Large hail, damaging wind, and an isolated tornado are all possible today, with storms that move through this evening. Some scattered showers or storms may persist into the early overnight hours as this initial area of low pressure moves away from the region. A few of these could be strong, too, but the threat diminishes closer to daybreak on Saturday. Temperatures on Friday will increase slowly throughout the day, reaching the mid-50s for many by the afternoon. Expect a cool and at times wet day. Another potential round of strong to severe storms on Saturday. We are likely to see a break for most of the start of Saturday, though some clouds may still be left behind as the first storm system exits the region to the northeast. These clouds should break up a bit, allowing at least partly sunny skies and increasingly warm temperatures by afternoon. Highs reach near 70 in the northwest, with possible 80s in the southeast. A warm front will likely stretch from southwest to northeast across our area, with communities along and south of it feeling sticky humidity conditions by the afternoon. This front will be the key to watch for potential storm redevelopment by the afternoon. It's not a guarantee that storms will actually fire up due to a lack of forcing to push air upward to develop into storms and a bit of a cap on the atmosphere from warm air aloft. But if they do, then they will turn severe. The Storm Prediction Center includes most of the area in a slight risk for severe storms as a result of this potential. The threats on Saturday include large hail and damaging wind, with a tornado or two possible. Some of the hail could be especially large in our southwestern and western counties during the afternoon and evening on Saturday. Even if those storms don't develop right on top of us on Saturday afternoon, storms that are much more likely to form to our west and southwest will track northeast into the area later in the evening and Saturday night. These will carry a risk for severe weather, with large hail and damaging winds to remain a threat. Heavy rainfall is also possible statewide. And now for Sunday. Showers and storms are likely to be ongoing on Sunday morning, and they may last into much of the day, at least on a scattered basis. This, combined with expected associated widespread cloudiness introduces some uncertainty on the potential for severe weather later in the day on Sunday. If things come together right, the risk does increase by afternoon into the evening again. The Storm Prediction Center has trimmed back its severe risk to mainly areas along and south of Interstate 80 on Sunday. If these storms take place, expect the risk for large hail, damaging wind, and an isolated tornado to be present. We want you to keep this risk in mind as we go through the next few days. Precipitation ends on Sunday night, with the second storm system finally moving away. We'll have at least some clouds around on Monday, and likely some gusty winds, as temperatures fall toward the upper 50s to mid-60s. Things warm up in a hurry on Tuesday, ahead of a fast-moving disturbance that gives us another shower and storm chance later into the day, into early Wednesday. Highs hit the 70s again, and likely stay there for a few days to follow. The end of next week looks somewhat cooler, with a chance for some rain by the start of the next weekend. Let's turn to the stories on the front page of the Courier today. The first story is titled, Body of Missing Wall Lake Trucker David Schultz Found in Sac County. This story was written by Dolly Butts and Mason Docker, Journal staff writers. The story begins with a color photograph of David Schultz sitting with his twin boys next to his Peterbilt semi-truck, all painted red with white stripes and lots of chrome, and in the background we see his stock trailer. And the caption of the photograph says, David Schultz is shown with his twin boys, Joseph and Isaac, by his Peterbilt semi. His wife Sarah's name is printed on the passenger door. Dateline, Sac City, Iowa. The body of missing Wall Lake trucker David Schultz was found in a Sac County field Wednesday afternoon, not far from where his semi-tractor trailer loaded with hogs was discovered abandoned over 5 months ago. An unidentified individual reported to the Sac County Sheriff's Office that he found a body in his farm field shortly before 2 p.m., according to a statement from the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Quote, the body was found near the intersection where the semi of missing person David Schultz was located in November of 2023, the statement said. The body is being transported to the Iowa Office of the State Medical Examiner for a forensic autopsy. The statement said no further details are being released at this time. Schultz, a married father of 10-year-old twins, vanished before Thanksgiving. He was last heard from in the early morning hours of November 21st, according to Lakeview Police Department. Schultz's red Peterbilt semi with white stripes was found the afternoon of November 21st, parked in the middle of the northbound lane of County Road N14, not far from where it intersects with D15 in northeastern Sac County. The trailer he rents was loaded with pigs, but Schultz was nowhere to be found on that stretch of paved roadway, which is flanked by cornfields. Last year, the United Cajun Navy, a Louisiana-based nonprofit that assisted in the search, and volunteers scoured more than 100,000 acres in and around Sac County looking for Schultz. The Journal reached out to Schultz's wife, Sarah Schultz, for comment. She declined to comment when contacted by a Journal reporter Wednesday evening. She is expected to hold a press conference Thursday morning near where the body was found, alongside Jake Rowley of the United Cajun Navy. Rowley told the Journal by phone Wednesday evening, Schultz's body was found in the vicinity of the intersection of Union Avenue and 190th Street in rural Sac County, northeast of Sac City. Rowley said he rushed from Marshalltown, Iowa, to Sac City Wednesday when he heard Schultz's body had been discovered. The place where Schultz's body was discovered, Rowley said, was not within the vast area searched by the United Cajun Navy. This, he said, was because it fell within an area that authorities said at the time had already been searched. Quote, the fire department, police department, and the sheriff's department from the area told us that they had a two-mile radius around where the truck was found, Rowley said. Quote, we had figured that the police department or the fire department or whoever, that original search party for the first few days, had searched the area. So we did not search that area, he added. Rowley also claimed that Schultz's body was in a state of decomposition, inconsistent with having been out in the elements for more than 5 months. The body, he said, was not as decomposed as it should have been under the circumstances, implying that, quote, it got dumped later, he said. The decomposition does not line up with 186 days from what I understand, Rowley said. Schultz was actually missing 155 days. Quote, there's a very good chance that the body wasn't there even when they searched, Rowley added, referring to the search conducted by local law enforcement and emergency responders, and that the body was placed thereafter. Sarah Schultz regularly posted updates on her Facebook page about her husband's case. She called his disappearance suspicious and said, quote, this is not something David would do. He would never leave. His family is his life. During a December 14th interview with the Journal, Schultz expressed frustration with local law enforcement and said she felt the case was more than small-town police can handle. Sac County Sheriff Ken McClure told the Journal that same day he was confident his office and the DCI would eventually solve the case. Efforts to reach McClure Wednesday evening were not immediately successful. The other story on the front page is titled Drawing Up Plans, Single Waterloo High School. First artist renderings of proposed new building is presented. Article by Courier staff, and it begins with a photograph of Waterloo Community School Superintendent Jared Smith as he gives the State of the District address Thursday during the Waterloo Schools Foundation's Sparking Academic Excellence Breakfast at Waterloo Convention Center. Dateline Waterloo. The Waterloo Community School District has unveiled three preliminary renderings that showcase the potential design of a unified high school campus. The artist's drawings were presented Thursday by Superintendent Jared Smith to attendees at the Waterloo Schools Foundation's annual Sparking Academic Excellence Breakfast. The renderings offer a glimpse into what could be a historic change for the district and community. On December 11th, Board of Education unanimously agreed to engage Envision Architecture of Waterloo to work with the district to conduct a comprehensive exploration of the educational needs of Waterloo School's secondary students. The motion authorized a high school steering committee made up of district leadership, board members, and building principals to collaborate with Envision. The group was asked to explore innovative ways to provide students with equitable educational offerings, extracurricular activities, and career and technical opportunities. The exploration included determining the feasibility of merging Waterloo's high schools into one campus. Quote, conversations regarding the consolidation of our high schools have been ongoing since 2012, Smith said in a news release. Our current board displays exceptional leadership by passing a motion to prioritize our students, underscoring their bold commitment to exploring and addressing the true needs of our district, unquote. The steering committee has engaged with department chairs, teachers, staff, and specialized user groups, including those focused on alternative learning, media, performing arts, special education, student services, and athletics. Discussions included detailed analysis and research addressing questions and concerns regarding the feasibility and logistics of the project, according to the release. The district has carefully assessed various factors and determined the optimal site, which would be adjacent to the Waterloo Career Center at 1348 Katoski Drive. Quote, it has become increasingly clear to us that the current age and structure of our high schools, spread out across three campuses, has limited our ability to provide our students with the same access to opportunities, Smith said. The most glaring example of this can be found in the current barriers that prohibit the majority of our students from accessing the Waterloo Career Center, unquote. Since its opening, officials say the WCC has served as an invaluable resource for students, offering career and technical education, internships, apprenticeships, and direct connection with industry experts. Statistics show that students who have access to the Career Center earn higher grade point averages, have better attendance, and are more likely to have a plan post-graduation than their peers, according to the district. Currently, scheduling and transportation prohibit the majority of high school students from accessing the WCC. The current distance between Waterloo's high schools and the Career Center vastly diminished the amount of students who can take advantage of the benefits. While garnering the expertise of educational professionals has been critical, the district also extended invitations to the community to provide input. Quote, "It has been paramount for us to harness the invaluable expertise and insights from our staff and community," Amy Schmidt, Director of Secondary Education, said in the release. Quote, "We deeply value the collaborative spirit that has been characterized our efforts thus far, recognizing that collective input enriches our decision-making process. We firmly believe that together we are stronger, and every voice matters," unquote. Recently, the district announced Expo High School will relocate to the new extension of the WCC, referred to as the WCCX. This move will take place prior to the start of the 2024-25 school year. Quote, "At the new campus, Expo High School students will have access to an abundance of resources and career opportunities, fostering collaboration and enriching their education," said Carrie Wieland, Expo High School principal. On July 8th, Smith, with the support of the High School Steering Committee, will recommend that the board approve plans to consolidate East High School and West High School, creating a new high school and bringing the traditions of East and West together on one campus. If the board approves the project, construction would start in 2025, with an estimated completion date of 2028. This would make the class of 2029 the inaugural graduating class of the new Waterloo High School. The district plans to release more information, including more renderings and additional ways the public can get involved in the process, prior to the July 8th vote. For more information, you may go online to waterlooschools.org/bridging-futures. Now, turning the page, we see a second story about the disappearing trucker David Schultz. It's titled, "Relief and Sorrow. Sarah Schultz, wife of missing truck driver David Schultz, speaks about the discovery of his body." Story written by Dolly A. Butts. And the dateline is Sac City, Iowa. No matter the weather or the occasion, Wall Lake trucker David Schultz always wore traditional cowboy boots. Schultz's brown Wrangler boots with blue on the soles is how the 53-year-old's body was identified after it was found lying face up in a field roughly 1.5 miles from where his semi-tractor trailer loaded with hogs was discovered abandoned over 4 months ago. Quote, "He always wore them in the summer and the winter. It didn't matter. He didn't wear work boots. Just always cowboy boots and jeans," Sarah Schultz said of her husband as she stood outside the white single-story Sac City Motel on Thursday morning, her shoulder-length, wavy, light brown hair blowing in the wind. Quote, "He didn't like it when truck drivers would wear sweatpants and flip-flops. To him, that's just appalling. It's disgusting. He does not respect that. He feels like he's representing the trucking community." And at this point in the article, we have a photograph showing a distraught Sarah Schultz. And the caption on the photograph says, "Sarah Schultz, the wife of Wall Lake truck driver David Schultz, cries while talking about the discovery of her husband's body on Wednesday during a press conference on Thursday in Sac City, Iowa. Continuing now with the text of the article, Schultz said she has felt relief and sorrow since she learned her husband's body had been discovered by a farmer in his freshly tilled field. The unidentified man found the body shortly before 2 p.m. Wednesday in the vicinity of the intersection of Union Avenue and 190th Street in rural Sac County, northeast of Sac City, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, the DCI. Quote, "I'm glad we know where he is," said Schultz, who said her husband's body is at the state medical examiner's office and was being autopsied Thursday. Quote, "There's still a lot of questions. You know, things just don't make sense," unquote. Schultz, a married father of 10-year-old twins, vanished before Thanksgiving. He was last heard from in the early morning hours of November 21st, according to the Lakeview Police Department. From what she understands, Schultz said her husband's body was found on its back, clad in a T-shirt, which was pulled up. She said law enforcement didn't show her a photo of the cowboy boots, but she said they were the same brand her husband always wore. Quote, "He had underwear on, and I think his jeans were down. His cowboy boots were on, I think," she said. "I know they identified him by the boots, because the last time he went and bought boots, he bought two pair of the exact same ones. I gave the sheriff one of the newer boots to have in comparison." Here we have another photograph showing Sarah Schultz from the back facing a string of reporters and cameras. Jack Rowley of the United Cajun Navy said Schultz's body was found in the original 2-mile radius that he had been told law enforcement had searched. He said the United Cajun Navy, which scoured more than 100,000 acres in and around Sac County looking for Schultz, didn't search that particular area. Schultz added that she recalled a thermal imaging drone from the Iowa Department of Transportation flying over. Quote, "That original area was just marked green out of the gate because, from my understanding, it had been searched by professionals," said Rowley, who said that raises, quote, "baffling questions about whether Schultz's body was there the entire time or not." The Iowa DCI could not be reached by the Sioux City Journal Thursday morning, and Sac County Sheriff's Office referred the journal to the Iowa DCI. Neither Schultz nor Rowley have viewed the body. Schultz has trouble grasping how her husband's body wasn't just bones, given the length of time that has passed since his disappearance and the relatively mild winter Northwest Iowa has experienced. Quote, "I can't believe it wasn't just bones by now, knowing there's animals, vultures, coyotes, and the way they made it sound, nothing was missing. It wasn't just bones. So I don't understand," she said. Schultz regularly posted updates on her Facebook page about her husband's case. She previously called his disappearance suspicious and said, quote, "This is not something David would do. He would never leave. His family is his life," unquote. During a December 14th interview with the Journal, Schultz expressed frustration with local law enforcement and said she felt the case was more than small-town police can handle. Ex-publisher describes scheme. Former Inquirer chief shielded his friend from damaging stories. Story comes from the Associated Press. Trump hush money criminal trial. Dateline New York. As Donald Trump ran for president in 2016, his old friend at the National Enquirer scooped up potentially damaging stories about the candidate and paid out tens of thousands of dollars to keep them from the public eye. But when it came to the seamy claims by porn performer Stormy Daniels, David Pecker, the tabloid's longtime publisher, said he put his foot down. Quote, "I am not paying for this story," he told jurors Thursday at Trump's hush money trial, recounting his version of a conversation with Trump's former lawyer Michael Cohen about the catch-and-kill scheme that prosecutors allege amounted to interference in the race. Pecker was already $180,000 in the hole on other Trump-related stories by the time Daniels came along, at which point he said, "I don't want to be involved in this," unquote. Pecker's testimony was a critical building block for the prosecution's theory that their partnership was a way to illegally influence the 2016 presidential election. Trump's lawyers also began their cross-examination of Pecker, using the time to question his memory of years-old events and to suggest his account had evolved over time. Trump maintains his innocence and says the stories that were brought and squelched were false. Pecker testified how he and his publication parlayed rumor-mongering into splashy stories that smeared Trump's opponents and, just as crucially, leveraged his connections to suppress unflattering coverage. He recalled that the publication bought a sordid tale from a New York City doorman and purchased accusations of an extramarital affair with former Playboy model Karen McDougal to prevent the claims from getting out. There was some talk of reimbursement from Trump's orbit, but Pecker was ultimately never paid. The breaking point came with Daniels, who was eventually paid by Cohen to keep quiet over her claim of a 2006 sexual encounter with Trump. Pecker advised that someone should do something to prevent the story from going public. Quote, "I said to Michael, my suggestion to you is that you should buy the story and you should take it off the market, because if you don't and it gets out, I believe the boss will be very angry with you," unquote. Judge rules in favor of Cedar Falls on dangerous dog declaration. Story written by Andy Malone. Cedar Falls. A judge has ruled that the city of Cedar Falls acted properly in determining that an allegedly dangerous dog be euthanized after 5-bite incidents. On Tuesday, District Court Judge Joel Dalrymple annulled the appeal by the attorney for Leanne and Chris Western, owners of the American Bully named Reese. Dalrymple felt evidence was adequate and no due process violations existed. However, the attorney, Jamie Hunter, immediately filed a motion to reconsider that would be the second failed appeal in the life of the fight to keep the beloved pet alive. Police Chief Mark Howard originally authorized putting the dog down last year, as he is allowed under city code. The 5-bite incidents reportedly happened between May 2021 and October 2023 at their home on 18th Street and at the relative's home on Clark Drive. The Westerns lost their first appeal on November 15th to the Cedar Falls City Council, the proceedings questioned in this second appeal. Quote, "An illegality is established if the board has not acted in accordance with a statute, if its decision was not supported by substantial evidence, or if its actions were unreasonable, arbitrary, or capricious," the judge wrote. Quote, "Evidence is not insubstantial merely because the court could draw a different conclusion from the record," unquote. Dalrymple also noted he didn't feel it was within the court's jurisdiction to grant an alternative remedy other than what the city declared should be the death of the dog. Hunter had asked that Reese be returned with restrictions to avoid future incidents after the couple had admitted to errors in handling their pet. She later gave the reason in filings that the dog's health was deteriorating as a result of the city's confinement at the Cedar Bend Humane Society. Reese has been there since October 15th, following the 5th incident involving a bicycle rider. Upon Tuesday ruling, Hunter objected in her motion to reconsider that, quote, "due to a lack of substantial evidence, Reese does not pose an unreasonable risk of threat or harm to any person, animal, or public safety pursuant to city code." The Westerns could appeal again to Iowa's appellate courts if Dalrymple's ruling ultimately stands. And now, listeners, we pause to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, April 26th on IRIS, that's I-R-I-S, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today was written by Art Cullen, and it is titled, More Bad Ideas Become Law. This was published in the Storm Lake Times Pilot. The Iowa legislature ended its session last weekend before it did even more harm. The Republican trifecta of the House, Senate, and Governor continued to push the state hard to the right, as it has for the past several years. This year, laws were passed that aim to arm school staff, have local police sweep up immigrants, cut funding to area education agencies, and consolidate several state boards and commissions that will limit citizen involvement in government. State funding for K-12 schools and universities increased by 2.5%. The Iowa tuition grant that keeps our private colleges going survived two attempts to undermine it. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs were banned at state universities, and private colleges were put on notice that legislators are watching. Beginning teacher salaries were set at $50,000, ignoring cost differentials between Newell and West Des Moines, or the challenges that rural districts face. The main targets this year in education were area education agencies, which took a $32.5 million cut. The Department of Education will set up a special education services division, which takes power away from AEA boards, comprised of local school board members, and puts it with the state. It also adds another layer of bureaucracy, which may well end up costing more in the long run. Schools will be able to use funds previously directed to AEAs for media services elsewhere. It remains to be seen how it all shakes out. The debate alarmed special ed parents who depend on AEAs for vital services for their children. Those parents got engaged in politics and lobbied hard against the worst excesses dreamt by Governor Reynolds. Messing with AEAs and private school vouchers last session are not popular. Arming school staff is another bad idea that ripened this session. After insurance companies told Spirit Lake and Cherokee school districts that they would not cover them with guns in schools, the legislature responded by offering immunity for school staff who went through gun safety training. Insurance companies still might not write policies for districts with guns in school. If a teacher shoots an innocent child in a melee, the insurance company might not be convinced that an immunity clause will be effective. It is difficult enough for districts to get affordable insurance these days without guns in the library and locker room. Lord protect us. An even worse idea, mainly for the sake of theater, is ordering local police to arrest undocumented immigrants. This has been a federal responsibility. Police in Storm Lake have enough to do chasing down bad guys without chasing down hardworking residents who came here at the invitation of Iowa employers. Texas passed a similar law that is held up in court for now. It will be horrible for food processing and agriculture if it is truly enforced. We don't know a practical way to deport half of Storm Lake on the city's general fund budget. You can be agnostic about consolidating boards, commissions, and agencies. It's good to clear out the cobwebs now and then. The fewer boards, the fewer citizens are involved, which is a shame. Boards that served ethnic groups like Latinos and Asians will be merged into one board, which limits distinct voices. Merging conservation and environmental protection under one agency, the Department of Natural Resources, has not been especially effective over the years. Just look at our state parks, where the rangers have disappeared, or the Storm Lake Marina, empty and neglected. Finally, legislators cut income taxes some more after cutting spending some more. They passed language for a constitutional amendment requiring Iowa to have a flat income tax rate, abandoning the progressive tax system. The goal eventually is to eliminate the income tax. This is supposed to lead Iowa to the land of milk and honey. After cutting, cutting, and cutting income taxes, Iowa's income growth rate is second worst in the nation, next to Mississippi. Schools can barely keep up. Parents are afraid about special ed services. Latinos have a target on their back and have been told they are not welcome here, and have no solutions to violence in the schools other than to strap on a 45. Our water quality is not getting better. There are some good things. Speed cameras were banned. Penalties were stiffened for violating the open meetings law. Yet, our rivers are the worst in America. Our cancer rate is among the highest. Our state highways are a fright. So what does the legislature do? Try to write a history curriculum with a right-wing spin that builds on book bans last session and a ban on teaching, quote, divisive concepts the year before that. They just won't leave us alone. When can we get this government off our backs? When they run out of per diem expenses and are forced to go home. Next, we have an editorial written by Rick Moraine titled Simple versus Supermajority. Tax bills in the Iowa legislature have always been approved or disapproved by simple majorities. If most legislators want to raise taxes or lower them, they do it the usual way. They take up a vote, up or down, and whichever side gets the most votes wins. That's how democracy works. But this year's legislators want to change that. Not all of them, but most of them. First, the Iowa House late last month, and then the Iowa Senate last week, approved a proposed amendment to the Iowa Constitution that would require a two-thirds majority in each house of the legislature to raise state income taxes. Changing the state's constitution isn't beanbag. Proposals to do that need to be approved in exactly the same wording by two successive sessions of the Iowa legislature, and then be submitted to the voters of the state in a statewide referendum. That means that this year's proposed amendment needs approval from the legislature in 2025 or 2026, and then approval by Iowa voters before it comes enshrined in the Iowa Constitution. That's a heavy lift, but not as heavy as trying to increase the state income tax if the amendment passes. The Iowa House is populated by 100 members, and the Iowa Senate by 50. Do the math. It would take only 34 House members, or just 17 senators, to block a tax bill that most legislators support. That's not the House and the Senate members, it's House or Senate members. Even if, say, the House were to support an income tax increase unanimously with all 100 members, just 17 senators could block it. Amendments to the Iowa Constitution do not require the governor's signature. If the legislature okays the proposed amendment in 2025 or 26, then it would go to the voters for their decision. Anti-tax forces in Iowa are doggedly persistent. They've been trying to wedge a supermajority requirement for income tax increases into the Iowa Constitution for at least the past 25 years. Never mind how desperately the state might need more revenue at some point in the future. The Holy Grail is to assure that a legislator who opposes an increase gets to outbalance two legislators who favor it. That's not democracy. Why should my senator and 16 others like him, theoretically, be empowered to overrule 33 who see a need for an increase? And to maintain that anti-tax wall into the future forever? Economic cycles go up and down. They always have, and Iowa doesn't control the national economy. A time will come when the state needs more revenue than its current tax structure can provide. When that time arrives, if the Iowa Constitution prevents the legislature from raising income taxes, even for the short term. Legislators will be forced to turn to the sales tax or property taxes for the necessary revenue. Neither option is preferable to the income tax in terms of individual ability to pay. The U.S. Constitution requires only a simple majority of members of Congress to declare war, but most Iowa legislators think it should take 2/3 of their colleagues to raise state income taxes. Does that make sense? One more note. The proposed amendment doesn't require a 2/3 majority to lower state income taxes. The supermajority requirement would kick in only to raise them. In 1789, in a letter to an acquaintance following the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin wrote, quote, "Our new Constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency. But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain, except death and taxes," unquote. For most Iowa legislators, the goal appears to be the death of taxes. Our author, Rick Moraine, is a reporter and a columnist with the Jefferson Herald. Our next editorial comes from the Des Moines Register, written by Rika Basu. Christianity is not under attack, but Kim Reynolds governs like it is. Did you ever wake up in such a state that you don't recognize where you are? That's me lately. I don't mean it in the ways you're probably imagining. I mean it about this state, Iowa, and where it is these days. Core freedoms were taken for granted to safeguard our property and our bodies, to love and worship or not as we choose, are being stripped or threatened. Then the rationalizations offered up for the changes turn logic on its head. In signing her, quote, Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law, Governor Kim Reynolds ironically declared, quote, "The right of our religious freedom is endowed upon us by our Creator, not government," unquote. But putting government into religion is exactly what she did, and not to promote religious tolerance or core teachings such as loving our neighbors and serving those in need. The law allows people to cite their religious beliefs to discriminate against others, even in non-secular civil society. In the same week, the governor cited her personal views to justify curtailing abortion rights, though most Iowans support legal abortions. Quote, "As a pro-life governor, I will do everything I can to protect the innocent unborn and promote strong, healthy families," she said, of the upcoming Iowa Supreme Court ruling that will determine whether her post-6 weeks abortion ban can take effect soon. Planned Parenthood attorney Peter Iam framed the issue this way, quote, "This court has recognized that autonomy and dominion over one's body goes to the very heart of what it means to be free," unquote. Freedoms for many Iowans are being tugged out like a rug from under us, replaced by the increasing exercise of autonomy from leadership that neither reflects the public's will nor serves its needs. And it's no longer a simple clash of Republican and Democratic priorities. The leadership's deference to special interests and lobby groups such as Big Ag, religious institutions, and the National Rifle Association trump traditional Republican priorities like lower taxes and less government interference in people's lives. Imagine how previous Republican Iowa leaders would have felt about compelling private property owners to let a private carbon-carrying pipeline company drill their land to install pipelines with no public benefit. Think of how hard former Governor Bob Rae worked to have Iowa sponsor and welcome Vietnam War refugees. Now consider Reynolds' new law empowering local police to act like federal immigration agencies and arrest any entering undocumented immigrant previously removed from Iowa or the nation. Where Rae set an example of empathy for families forced to flee their homelands, Reynolds portrays them as criminals. Remember how in December, despite her claims to support families, the governor declined $29 million in federal-funded grocery cards for 240,000 low-income Iowa children? She complained about child obesity. Now, she's expanding Healthy Meals program with $900,000, also federal money, by offering competitive grants to local organizations that may or may not be able to fill the need. Iowa leaders once prided and funded our public schools to be great. Now, through the voucher program, even current tuition-paying private school students who don't need the help get state money. And it goes to predominantly religious schools, which most private Iowa schools are. What should be a violation of the constitutional separation of church and state was gotten around by the state giving taxpayer money to parents instead of directly to the schools. The damage isn't just in the voucher law itself, but in the unilateral process used to achieve it. Remember in 2022, when some legislators in Reynolds' own Republican Party opposed the voucher plan? She got others to challenge them in elections and win, using money from the Americans Federation for Children, a PAC started by former U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. DeVos's goal was implementing vouchers around the country. That's the same DeVos the New York Times editorialized in 2021, quote, will be remembered as perhaps the most disastrous leader in the education department's history, unquote. To complete this cycle, Mackenzie Snow, a former aide to DeVos, has now been confirmed by the Senate to head Iowa's state education department. Every Democrat voted against Snow, who never held a teaching license and whose previous education policy work involved school choice advocacy. Whether through school vouchers, repeated moves to undermine abortion rights and transgender people, or her Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the governor doesn't just put religion into public policy. As one observer of such measures points out in Rob Reiner's documentary, God and Country, quote, there is no religious freedom without freedom from religion. Laws like these are founded on the faulty premise that Christianity is under attack, which the film contends is fueling a dangerous movement of Christian nationalism around the country. The January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol are one example. Told mostly in the voices of former movement members, the film shows how the idea of persecution is being invoked nationwide with buzzwords like woke and critical race theory to undermine America's growing multiculturalism. They're spreading the false idea that America was founded as a Christian nation that is now under attack. In fact, as the narrator reminds us, quote, the U.S. was the first country to have a secular constitution and no religious tests for public office, unquote. A clip from 2016 inside Liberty University shows Donald Trump telling a crowd during his presidential campaign, quote, Christianity is under tremendous siege. Christians don't use their power. You have the strongest lobby ever, but I don't hear about a Christian lobby, unquote. Trump got 81% of the votes of white evangelical Christians that year. Evangelical entrepreneurs are said to be raising billions of dollars for political campaigns that play on fear and anger and champion autocracy and authoritarianism. In a free nation or state, no one else gets to dictate how the rest of us live if we're obeying the laws. If you don't believe in abortions, don't have one. Public money should be spent for public purposes. Consider this a wake-up call, because it's anyone's guess what could be coming next for Iowa unless we use our voices and our votes to stop it. A note about the author, Rika Basu, is a longtime syndicated columnist, editorial writer, and reporter whose work has appeared in all but two U.S. states. She retired in 2022 as a columnist for the Des Moines Register. Now from the New York Times, we have an editorial titled, "The Small Business Tyrant Has a Favorite Political Party," written by Jamel Bowie. Despite the blue-collar affectations of some of its most visible leaders, or the populist rhetoric of its most vocal cheerleaders, it has never been more obvious that the Republican Party is the party of the boss, and in particular, the party of the small business tyrant. Who or what is the small business tyrant? It's the business owner whose livelihood rests on a steady supply of low-wage labor, who opposes unions, who resents even the most cursory worker protections and employee safety regulations, and who views those workers as little more than extensions of himself to use as he sees fit. The small business tyrant is, to borrow an argument from the writer and podcaster Patrick Wyman, an especially reactionary member of America's land-owning gentry, local economic elites whose wealth comes primarily from their ownership of physical assets. Those assets, Wyman explains, quote, vary depending on where in the country we're talking about. They could be a bunch of McDonald's franchises in Jackson, Mississippi, or a beef processing plant in Lubbock, Texas, a construction company in Billings, Montana, commercial properties in Portland, Maine, or a car dealership in Western North Carolina. To look at Republican politics at the state level is to see an economic agenda dominated by the worst of this particular class. Last summer, for example, in the midst of a dangerous heat wave that put thousands of lives at risk, Governor Greg Abbott of Texas signed a law nullifying local rules requiring water breaks for outdoor workers. The law targeted provisions passed by officials in Austin and Dallas that gave construction workers a 10-minute break every 4 hours. Quote, for too long, progressive municipal officials and agencies have made Texas small businesses jump through contradictory and confusing hoops, said Dustin Burroughs, the Republican state representative who introduced the bill. Burroughs, it should be noted, is a small business owner himself. More recent is a Florida bill signed into law this month by Governor Ron DeSantis that similarly forbids local governments from setting heat exposure rules for workers. Backed by business groups, the law also prevents governments from, quote, maintaining a minimum wage other than a state or federal minimum wage. Even if a city wants one of its vendors to provide a higher wage than the statewide minimum of $12, it can't. Quote, small business owners don't have the time or the resources to navigate a confusing and contradictory array of local ordinances that go beyond what the state already mandates, said Bill Harrell, Florida director of the National Federation of Independent Business. Consider as well a Kentucky bill that would, if enacted, eliminate workers' rights to lunch and rest breaks. Federal labor law does not require employers to offer either. The purpose of this bill, introduced by State Representative Philip Pratt, a Republican, is to modernize Kentucky labor law to match the federal standard, or lack thereof. Pratt, who owns a landscaping business, says that he would continue to offer those breaks. This is just a smattering of examples of an anti-labor political and economic agenda that rests on weakening whatever protections working people might have from their employers. It's of a piece with the continued effort by Republican lawmakers in Congress to slash the social safety net and weaken unions nationwide. And it puts the lie to the idea circulating among some Republicans in the wake of the 2020 presidential election that Republican Party had somehow become a workers' party. There is one other element to the effect that the former president may have on the rest of the Republican Party. Trump is not simply a person who owns a business. He is someone for whom his status as boss is integral to his personal, public, and political identity. Look no further than his central role on The Apprentice. In the role of president, Trump sees himself as boss of the United States. You cannot blame the authoritarian tendency in contemporary Republican policies on a single person or tie it to a single source. But I do think that the rhetoric and even the aesthetics of that tendency owe quite a bit to the party's total identification with a man who sees himself as nothing other than the man on top, the one who, quote, alone can fix it, unquote. Cedar Falls' Merrick Jessups Miller, HDC's Morton, crowned champs on day one of the Drake Relays. Dateline Des Moines. A trio of local athletes earned Drake Relays titles on the first day of the high school portion of the event on Thursday. Cedar Falls' Jaden Merrick took first in the 3,200-meter race with a time of 8 minutes 55.14 seconds. The star led through the first six circuits of the Blue Oval, but fell behind during the seventh lap. The sophomore pulled off the win with a 1 minute 1.8 split in the final lap, passing Ankeny's Ethan Zuber to claim the title. Merrick's final lap was his fastest lap of the competition. Jessup's Jack Miller managed a win in the boys' long jump competition with a leap of 23 feet, 3.75 inches. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for this Friday, April 26th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other papers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.